Voice of Commentary Live. Today, we're going to take a look at the candidates running for office, the issue of how and why democracy is being threatened, and what is the election cycle ignoring and denying. My guest, continuing with our conversation with Remarkable Minds, is Danny Sheehan. Danny is one of our nation's most important and influential constitutional and public interest lawyers. During his at least 45 years, he has handled such public interest cases as the Pentagon Papers, the Watergate break-in, Iran-Contra, the Karen Silkwood case, and more recently, he has been helping represent the Native Nations at Standing Rock in handling the dismissal of a case against Chase Iron Eyes for inciting a riot and felony trespassing. Danny is the founder of the Romero Institute, a nonprofit public policy center in Santa Cruz, California. And more recently, he founded the New Paradigm Institute, which explores new pathways to world peace. He holds a law degree and divinity degrees from Harvard University. He is the author of The People's Advocate, The Life and Legal History of America's Most Fearless Public Defense Lawyer. And his websites are Daniel P. Sheehan, SHEEHAN.com, and RomeroInstitute.org. Danny, it's nice always to have you with us, and I'm going to ask you a series of questions that are on the minds of many Americans, and then take your time to answer them. What we see today is that there has been the weaponization of arguments. For example, if you have a different, more humane way of helping people at the border, suddenly you're attacked by one side or the other. But what we're not doing is actually coming up with a unified policy that, in a humane way, actually helps the people at the border. We have public schools that have been gutted, where administrators and supervisors make all the money, and it doesn't filter down to the school teachers nor the pupils. We have elite institutions that have accepted money from private industry, including the pharmaceutical industry, the military-industrial complex, and big energy and big agra. Now, of course, then, whenever there is a challenge, let's say the challenge of, are GMO safe? How do they compare with organic? Then suddenly comes forth a series of professors from these universities say, no, GMOs are safe, there's no problem in organic. Well, that's kind of faddish, but it's not the truth. And at no time during that hearing is it divulged that that professor was given money and the university or the chair of the department that biased their opinions. We have people who say, well, gee whiz, shouldn't we do something about income inequality? And the answer is yes. But nothing's being done. Shouldn't we do something about the environment and global warming and all the other environmental degradations, such as acidification of the ocean, the dying of all these mammals and fish and overfishing? Yes, but nothing's being done. The agencies that are officially overseeing these have been captured, but the media does not have a discussion, nor do the candidates have a discussion. When it comes to taking an honest look at American interventionism, our need for hegemony in the world, there's been no discussion about who should be held accountable for the tens of thousands of dead innocent civilians in Libya. Where's the actual proof that Libya was needing invaded and destroyed? There is none. And if you open that door, you would have to then make Barack Obama and Joe Biden and all the people in Congress, including most of the candidates who voted in support of that, including Hillary Clinton, and they won't do it. So it's not going to be touched. When you talk about reestablishing Glass-Steagall to protect the small banks, it won't be discussed. The need for opening public banks where the public controls them, not discussed. When it talks about forgiving student debt, only a few people have discussed it. And Elizabeth Warren unfortunately discussed it, but she is so pro-industries, including the military-industrial complex, as is Bernie Sanders. The only candidate that I see that represents humanistic and holistic values and who has the courage to speak the truth is Tulsi Gabbard. But she won't be taken seriously. She would be if she were vice president candidate with Bernie Sanders. Bernie's foreign policies are terrible. You know, he does not. Now he is speaking out about, you know, Palestinian rights, but no one else is. They're all acting like they're the modern day American Zionists in support of that. We're not talking about what we did in Honduras with regime change or in Syria by aiding and abetting the terrorists there to destabilize a democratically elected government of Assad. Our media is aware of all this. These are bright people, and yet they're not telling us the truth about real stories. They tell us the official version. Our deep state, the CIA, the National Security Agency, leak secrets all the time to their advantage. They're never held accountable, never once, unless it's a whistleblower, in which case they end up going to prison or escaping the country. So when I look at the country today and I see how many people are suffering, and I see the rate of our illiteracy, and I see the rate of our child death. We're number one in the developed world for mortality of babies and young children, toddlers. And yet we're spending more on medicine and getting the least good results. And no one's talking about it. They only talk about what they're told to talk about, and they were selected before they're now going to be elected. So real citizens, much like Jill Stein or Rocky Anderson or Ralph Nader, who cannot be bought and who are going to tell you the truth and have very progressive policies that would really help the country, they're excluded and mocked and ridiculed by the left, especially the left in its stupid denunciation of Ralph Nader, instead of looking at the truth of what you have in Al Gore, the foremost vulture capitalist on the green movement. Yeah, he wants green. Providing it's ones at his hedge fund, which is $7 billion, can make money from. So we don't even have intelligent questions or intelligent reviews or intelligent debates, and we have a group of people who are the least qualified. And lastly, when you look in the backgrounds of these candidates, with the exception of only one of them, they're horrific. They have done terrible things, and they should not be even considered, yet they are. Please take us through what we need to know so that we can make intelligent, informed choices in the future. The forum is yours.
Well, it's interesting, Gary, because I've just come out of a long meeting this morning where we've been asked to draft the California State Green New Deal as a template for how we could actually address the realities of global climate change. And we've been having these discussions. I have a series of interns from various law schools and Santa Clara University and University of California, Santa Cruz, where I teach here. We're all working on this. And these very same discussions have come up that you've raised here about how we go about trying to address a very specific problem. How do we get an objective identification of the problem in light of the fact that these various camps are distorting and deceiving people as to what the actual content is of these problems? And they're also requiring that you take a litmus test before you can make any solution proposed. So these issues we've been addressing. I've attempted to deal with this when I was, as you know, I was for 10 years, I was in charge at the Jesuit National Headquarters in Washington, D.C. for public policy. And we would have meetings monthly with the heads of the various religious denominations in the country and the various public interest organizations, ranging from the Sierra Club to the American Civil Liberties Union to the National Organization for Women, et cetera, when I spent 20 years in Washington, D.C., trying to determine how it was that legislation could actually be not only designed to address certain problems, but could actually garner the potential support of citizen constituencies around the country. So I've been at this particular process here for some 50 years now. I just received the first invitation for my 50th reunion at law school, law school reunion at Harvard Law School, and realized suddenly that I've been at this for 50 years trying to address these issues that you've raised here. And I think that one of the things that we need to do right at the very beginning is we need to have some capacity to look at objective facts. This is an absolutely critical element of addressing any of these public policy problems, because there is this whole kind of postmodern excess that's been going on now through the whole philosophy of postmodernism. Postmodern philosophers have come to the realization that most of the ethical systems, normative systems, that have been set forth in both Western and Eastern civilization have been constructs that have been constructed by people who want to be in a position of privilege, and so that they've seized upon certain factual assertions about reality itself and have postulated those premises, and then have gone about building an entire system of ethics and normative principles and standards that should be used to determine reality. And therefore, the postmodernists have looked at this and said, well, look, you have an entire, for example, white male property owner, a capitalist kind of clique in Western civilization that have postulated the superiority of males over females, white people over people, non-white people, wealthy people and property owners over non-property owners, people who are, you know, industrious and parsimonious and clean living over people who are not. They've attempted to identify certain criteria for prisming reality, and it turns out that the critique of those systems is legitimate, that those systems have been arbitrarily and capriciously constructed by those who benefit from those types of choices of reality. And so the problem is now, as you pointed out at the beginning of your comments, that there's been such an assault on any standards by means of which you can determine facts and reality, that there's an attempt to disassemble any kind of basic understandings of what the criteria are for determining objectively what facts are, that there's been this assault on the fabric of reality itself. In fact, Pope Francis, in his papal encyclical on global climate change, raised this very issue about the excesses of postmodernism in attacking and deconstructing any type of underlying factual predicates for a normative system. And it's kind of thrown all of that up into this confusion on the part of people now who have been subjected to the internet and cable channels and various forms of media now that technologically can adopt any particular view of reality or attack any view of reality. And so many people are at sea right now. They can't quite determine what they should think about things. They can't determine what the facts are. And so that what they've done is they've been targeted by the military, industrial, and kind of capitalist financial elite to try to turn them into consumers, just simply consuming, and pointing out to them that, look, in this sea of confusion, the one thing that you can be dependent on is that you should, in fact, have as much as you can possibly get, earn as much money as you possibly can, respect those who have been able to make lots and lots of money, depend upon them to make decisions for the collective community, and you just go along for the ride. You just accept the benefits of a system like this through this trickle-down process of the wealthy and the powerful elite will kind of allow to descend down to you benefits, economic benefits, material benefits that are that match your degree of cooperation in this system. And that's a referent that you can experience every day. You don't have to think about it. You don't have to critique it. Just go along for the ride. Now, in the United States, you have a system here where, of course, with only something like 5% to 6% of the population of the entire planet, we end up consuming almost 50% of all of the non-renewable resources that are developed in the world every single annual year. And so we have been bought off for the most part. That this distribution, even though it's extraordinarily unequal, even though, you know, something almost like 40% of all the wealth in the entire United States is owned by 1% of the people in the country, even with that extraordinary disparity in the actual distribution of the benefits of our nation state, consuming 40% of all of the natural resources of the world, at only 5 or 6% of the population, that there is so much of these resources coming into this country that even an unequal distribution of these down into the rest of the people through this trickle down process has bought off an adequate number, an adequate percentage of the people that they simply go along with what it is that the white male elite capitalist property owners and financiers who send their children primarily to the best universities, the Ivy League universities around the country, in the top level state schools such as Berkeley or UCLA or others, that this elite is viewed by the average person in the United States as somehow being not only entitled, almost by a kind of dint of an aristocratic nobility that is left over from the royalist era, but that in fact somehow they're actually substantively more qualified. They're more intelligent, they're better educated, they know the right people, they have adequate experience in traveling around the world and getting to meet everybody, that somehow they are perfectly appropriate to be the ones making the decisions for us. And what we'll do is we'll just lay back and get a job, you know, just go get basically a high school education, which is getting to be less and less and less effective in giving anybody any kind of genuine insights or skill sets to do any kind of critical thinking. And that we'll just go along for the ride. Now, there is, in fact, even in this process, a number of people who are falling below the so-called poverty line. The poverty line is also identified by the same elite. And what they're saying is that in order to be below the poverty line, you have to not be able to even provide for a family of three or four with a regular job, working 40 hours a week. You fall below the poverty line. And so that we've identified this kind of isolated group of the people below the poverty line. They aren't even expected to participate in the electoral system. They're living in such dire consequences that they don't participate. They don't get educated. They don't vote. They don't have adequate funds to participate as consumers. So it's not viewed as they're generating any kind of demand for any kind of services or goods. So that we're looking at the rest of the people that are above the poverty line, who are sharing to one extent or another in the dividing up of the remaining 60% of all the wealth in the country that isn't owned by the 1%. And so that's the kind of situation that we're looking at here. And so what the people in the 1%, this elite, what they're doing right now, and you've put your finger on it, is they're attempting to fracture and fragment the constituency. This group of people, the 90% of the people that are in this category that aren't the 10% of the people, for example, that fall below the poverty line, and they're not in the 1% of this elite, but this other 89% of the people in the country, that they're trying to fracture all of us. They're trying to say, well, there are black people, there are men and women, there are Hispanic people, there's Chinese people, there's Oriental people. What they're saying is, look, that if we could somehow seal off our boundaries of our country and just deal with a set number of people that are in our country, the elite are perfectly willing and capable of figuring out what percentage each of these constituencies should get in order to be adequately bought off of the wealth that can be distributed down to them, this 60% of the total net income coming into the United States in goods and services in any given year. The elite are capable of dividing those up and distributing them among those people to keep them cowed, to keep them subservient, to keep them allowing the elite to stay in power and to be making all of these decisions. What's happened now is that the postmodern philosophy that has risen since the late 20th century, actually, has come into play, where the people are starting to doubt any legitimate sources of authority. Now, I was having a conversation about this with Sarah, our executive director, the other day, and they were saying, well, you know, we in the baby boom generation have helped participate in this by challenging the war in Vietnam, challenging the conclusions that were come to by the Warren Commission, challenging the legitimacy of the Central Intelligence Agency, questioning the validity of the FBI and their independence, questioning the bona fides of our government institutions, and that somehow we, the baby boomer generation, are being blamed for, you know, casting doubt upon all these institutions of authority. But that isn't true, because what I said is, like, for us to have critiqued these institutions does not mean that we don't believe in the legitimacy of institutions. It's not that we don't believe in the legitimacy of genuine normative principles. What we're saying is that we do believe in those things, and these institutions have not been complying with the publicly professed standards and belief systems and normative principles. And so all we're trying to do is to make those things real. Those promises that have been made to us, that people would have the right to truth from their government, their right to participate in the electoral process, their right to participate in a free and open economy, to be able to be rewarded for the skills that they have, to be able to have access to education so that they can be able to develop their talents and skills pursuant to their own attributes, rather than
Danny,
being, yes.
Let me add something that I'd like you to follow up on, please. It was just
yes.
triggered by what you just said.
Uh-huh.
It is my contention that we don't have the type of free and open democratic society that we claim to the world and to our own citizens we have. We have very wealthy people. Some call them oligarchs, some call them insiders.
Yep.
Those very wealthy people have made their money in different fields, and rarely, if ever, is the field that they've earned their income in germane to the political process. They surround themselves with highly skilled technocrats and people who will carry forward a policy. So whether it's the Koch brothers or George Soros or hundreds of other people like them, and they will say, I want to see people in power who represent this view, who support this ideology. And then they look around to see who's out there, and they select someone who will honor their views. They're generally groomed, they're coached, they're giving talking points, they're rehearsed. And so when we finally see that someone is running for an office, it's never an organic, spontaneous, extemporaneous event. It is always, you were selected, now we've got to get you elected. Then in this group of people, the power people behind the scenes, you have the media. There was a time when we had over 1,900 different media in the United States that were independent. Now we have six corporations that control over 90% of all media. And the two most powerful would be Google and Facebook, well, three, and Wikipedia. And yet those are completely controlled by political ideologues. They're wealthy, but more importantly than their wealth, they have the power to decide what the public is allowed to know about someone or exclude from knowing about someone. So let's just give an example. If someone says, I really don't support American interventionism around the world. In the old days, we would call it imperialism, taking over countries, we would call colonialism. And today we call it bringing democracy and freedom to a country. That's what we said about Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya. And look at those places. It's a form of genocide. 20 million people have been killed in the world since the end of World War II by American interventions. So, does the average person know the truth about the war in Yemen and America supporting it with the United Arab Emirates? Do they even know who the United Arab Emirates are? Do they know what Saudi Arabia is really about? Because on the one hand, we have people like Hillary Clinton in the last two election cycles who was supportive of Saudi Arabia. At the same time, she was supporting Saudi Arabia because of their arms deals that the State Department could take credit for, and she actually bragged about that. They were cutting off people's heads. They were having women stoned to death. They were throwing gays tied to chairs off buildings. They would then hang their bodies, frequently crucified and beheaded, up on cranes so people could see them. They were assassinating people. They were supplying terrorists. But then it turns out the United States was also supplying the same terrorist, ISIL, and our ISIS and Al-Qaeda and al-Nusra in different countries because we wanted Syria to be gone and we wanted Libya to be gone and in its form that it had. And no one in this media is allowed to ask those questions, the people that supported this. Joe Biden supported it and all these other legislators supported these interventions or regime changes or these coups in Honduras. So we allowed people to be selected. And how do I know? Because everyone in the world of business supported them. Everyone supported both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. Wall Street, and now look at Obama, getting $60 million for a book and $80 million to do a film series. He has no background in film. He's never directed, written, or produced a film, never starred in a film. And yet, ask the average person, would you take someone with no experience in a field and give them $80 million and say, now you got your own studio as part of Netflix? No. That and why would you give someone $2 million over, you know, five speeches on Wall Street when the speeches, if anyone's ever attended them, they'll tell you they're boring. They tell you nothing new. And then all of big pharma, all of big energy, the oil and cartels, all the big agra, Monsanto, and all of them all supported the Clintons and Obama. Why? Because they were selected before they were elected because they knew that these people would never do anything that would interrupt their profit or bring any form of embarrassment to the people who run these. None of the people went to jail during the fiasco under Obama. From the financial meltdown that caused $16 trillion to disappear in the average person's value of their homes and property. So I'm concerned, Danny, that what you're talking about is more of an ideal that we should not have income disparity. We should not have the media focusing upon how good we're doing, how low unemployment is when they're not telling us the honest unemployment numbers, which are actually closer to 22%. They're not telling us about all the people who don't have $500 in their savings account and couldn't go 1 week without an income or they'd be in trouble. They don't tell us about debtors' prisons that both Kamala Harris and these people have supported. They don't tell us about what we're really doing for resources in these foreign excursions. They don't tell us about all of the privatization of natural public projects. So how in the world can someone actually vote for someone when the truth of that person's history and background and what they've supported in the big financial interests, having selected them and protected them, and at the same time now attacking anyone who investigates and exposes these people's corruption or lack of moral authority in the choices they've made in their careers. And that's almost all these Democratic candidates, with the exception of the one from Hawaii. Give me your thoughts on that, please.
Yes, I agree that one of the things that we've been talking about here at the Romero Institute is the leadership of our Romero Institute. As you know, for 20 years was the leadership of the Christic Institute that did a number of these major litigations and investigations around the country, where we have devoted ourselves to trying to expose this very reality that you're articulating here to the people, to keep the people from following like sheep the kind of dictates of this elite. And what we're trying to do now is we're trying to say, okay, in light of the fact that we've now gotten a substantial number of the people to doubt the validity of these people, such that, for example, you can have a person like Bernie Sanders actually competing openly for the presidential nomination of one of the two major parties, you know, advocating programs that take into account the very reality that we're articulating here. And so the question is, what can we do about this now? And what I was just talking about before I came in here to come on the air was identifying the constituencies in the country that we need to address, and that there are people at different levels of education, different levels of economics, different living conditions that they're in. How do we reach out to them in light of the fact that we now have access to the internet? And as you know, there is this major effort going on the part of the owners of the internet and on the part of the United States government, reactionary forces, to get control of this, to keep the internet from becoming a source of information for people that is objective. What we need to do is we need to, now that we've taken the steps to convey to people what the problems are, how do we in fact offer concrete public solutions to these problems? And I think, for example, that Bernie Sanders, getting information to Bernie Sanders to re-educate him about foreign policy and things that he isn't quite up to date on here. Tulsi Gabbard, the young senator from Hawaii that you mentioned, to get information to her so that she can come forward and Bernie can come forward as advocates of not only identifying what these underlying structural problems are in our democracy, but offering concrete solutions such as Bernie is proposing right now. At the moment, this is one of the great opportunities that we have of filling in the content of those two particular candidacies within the Democratic Party. Obviously, there are no candidates that have risen in the Republican side, but there are 22 Republican senators that are coming up for election this election cycle that need to be targeted. There are some extraordinarily red states that their senators in that you don't have any real chance of unseating those people. But there are a half a dozen or more seats in the so-called purple states where there's a chance of getting an insurgent into those seats. And there are 435 congressional races that are going on right now that the insurgents can come in and adopt truly progressive positions to solve some of these problems. Now, I just had a meeting last week with the people from the Democratic Central Committee here in California, and they confirmed to us that the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, the DCCC, that control the flow of Democratic Party funds to congressional candidates, they've taken the position now in a memo that if, in fact, any insurgent challenges any sitting Democratic congressperson, if they challenge them and win the primary against them, that the Democratic campaign committee for the congressional committee will refuse to give any funds from the Democratic Party to that candidate in their race against the Republican person. Even in congressional districts where, you know, whoever the Democratic Party nominee is, as a rule, could get elected. So we're at a point right now where there's all kinds of evidence that the elite that are in charge of the Democratic and Republican parties together are very concerned, very frightened that there are openings now with the internet and the communication system that we have to reach out to the people where genuine policies can be proposed and the constituency can be educated about not only the flaws in the system, but the remedy for these flaws in the system. For example, I believe that one of the things we need to advocate is the dissolution of shareholder-owned private corporations. The whole creation of this type of vehicle, business vehicle, back in the 1870s, during the rise of the robber baron era, that the creation of a corporate vehicle by means of which business can be undertaken solely and exclusively for the enrichment of those who own the assets of the company as shareholders, and they're completely immunized against any type of legal liability for the activities of the corporation. And the management of the corporation are completely immunized legally against tort claims or criminal prosecution, and the boards of directors are immunized. You know, that it's absolutely inevitable that a corporate vehicle of that nature that is openly dedicated to nothing more than the maximization of their profits for their shareholders, with the immunity of those shareholders for any legal liability about what that corporation does, is going to do exactly what they've been doing, raping and pillaging, you know, offloading all the costs of the contaminants, the pollutants into the streams, rivers and streams of our country, pumping the carbon up into the atmosphere and generating global climate change. This is one of the things, for example, that can be done. The elimination of the private shareholder-owned corporation as a legitimate vehicle for doing business in the country, so that any group of people that want to get together and exercise their entrepreneurial skills, fine and dandy, and they can make money doing what they're, but they have to be held legally accountable for whatever the business decisions are that they make. That is a major systemic change that needs to take place. Also, the public financing of the elections, that this whole reliance upon financial wealth to fund these campaigns, it's inevitable that the rich people, they discovered this back during the robber baron era, let's just pay for the campaigns of these congressmen, senators, governors, state assemblymen and state senators. You know, let's just pay for their campaigns and get them to do what we tell them to do. You know, this has to be cured. There needs to be public financing of the campaigns. There needs to be the elimination of the shareholder-owned corporation as a legitimate business vehicle. There are certain systemic changes that need to be made. Bernie Sanders has been advocating some of those. Tulsi Gabbard, who has come on board, the young senator from Hawaii, is a person of sound integrity who is saying things and advocating things, especially in the foreign policy area, to keep the U.S. military from being used as a tool to garner unto ourselves a privileged access to the strategic raw materials of the world, to be put into the hands of our corporations to generate private profits for these shareholders. This has got to be stopped. And people like Bernie Sanders and Tulsi Gabbard, hopefully Elizabeth Warren, can be brought into this dialogue to publicly speak out to get people to respond to this call. Now, I think we have an example right now with Donald Trump. Donald Trump has so alienated such a large percentage of the people in the country for various reasons we could all go into. But the fact of the matter is there is a high probability right now that whoever the Democratic Party nominates to be the president and whoever the Democratic Party nominates to be senators in these races against the 22 Republican senators, whoever the Democratic Party nominates, or the people voting in the primaries of the Democratic Party nominate to be members of Congress coming up, if we can get them to advocate a half a dozen very specific, clear programs, like the elimination of the private shareholder-owned corporation, the public financing of elections, the overturning of the United States Supreme Court case, the Citizens United, the purports that corporations are people possessing the same fundamental rights as a human being. These are three of the half a dozen major issues that need to be dealt with. The fourth one, of course, is the Green New Deal. This entire effort to mobilize our entire country to deal with the issues of global climate change and the contamination of our atmosphere. You know, this is something that has to be done right now, and that the Green New Deal provides a structure pursuant to which the programs can be carried into effect without exacerbating the unjust structures that exist of racial discrimination, gender discrimination, the unequal distribution of resources. All of these can be addressed in the context of a Green New Deal, an omnibus Green New Deal Act. That's why we're drafting the one here out of the Romero Institute for the state of California that we're going to be tendering. It's now, at the present time, it's a 450-page bill. It's got 30 separate sections in it addressing fundamental issues, which include, for example, a state bank, setting up something to cut into the power of the Federal Reserve, to cut into the power of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, to set up banking institutions on a state level that can have state banks that are publicly owned and that, in fact, are giving loans to people that can help solve global climate change and at the same time be done in a non-racially discriminatory manner, and gender discrimination. This bill, the Green New Deal, is an offering that when put together with the opportunity that exists now to have the Democratic Party voters actually be able to nominate people who are going to propose these solutions and speak out on behalf of educating the American people about what the flaws in the system are that we're being deceived and missing out on, that this can be done. And in addition to their doing these contrived debates, on the major corporate-owned media, that we can do this through the Internet. There can be major presentations of these issues on the part of the candidates over the Internet and get people to pay attention to this and to listen to this, that we have to engage in for the next 18 months a full-scale public affirmative program of educating the American people about the lies that they're having been told and what the concrete solutions are that are within the immediate term where they can vote for these issues and get them implemented. This, I think, is the solution, Gary. And we have to get people to understand the kind of poisoning that's happening through their food that they eat, to understand what the importance of organic food is all about. So we have in the Green New Deal bill in California the actual turning over of public land into turning into farms so that the soil can be tilled, that they have publicly financed organic waste disposal centers where the organic waste can be gathered and processed and then and spread into the soil of public lands so that they can draw down carbon. This is a major piece that we're doing here out of the Romero Institute with the California Green New Deal statute. It's comprehensive. It's detailed. It addresses virtually all of these issues. It proposes the establishment of a state bank in California to help finance these operations, to break the power of the Federal Reserve and the major International Monetary Fund and World Bank. These are concrete solutions that after 50 years of working in the field, attempting to expose the falsehoods that have been proselytized on behalf of by the rich and the wealthy and the elite, these are the concrete solutions that are rooted in the insight that we've gathered as an entire generation for the past 50 years. And that's what I think people should get behind. Get behind the Green New Deal. Get behind the candidates that you want to be nominated and you want to have elected. And we need to engage in a major offensive because, you know, we have approximately 5 years. It's not 10 years. This kind of myth that's being spun by the Democratic Party. Oh, we've got 10 years to deal with global climate change. You know, right now we're on the brink of seeing the permafrost areas of the entire planet thawing out and potentially pluming up into our atmosphere methane gas that is 30 times more damaging to our atmosphere than simple carbon. This is a process that has to be arrested now. We have to move immediately. This election cycle that we are talking about here today, Gary, this election cycle is probably the most important single election cycle in the history of the United States, other than 1932, when Franklin Roosevelt got elected, or back when Abraham Lincoln got elected. This is one of the two or three most important elections in the entire history of the United States. And so we need to mobilize accordingly. We need to educate our people accordingly. We need to give our people concrete, practical policies and legislation that they can vote for.
We're coming up to about 7 minutes before the end of the program. I'd like for you to address one other issue, and that is the media seems remiss in covering the life of average people. They mock those people as some form of defective and deformed intellectual stereotype in sitcoms. They create images of what it's like to be the average person, and yet they're not the average person. There was a discussion between Ernest Hemingway and Scott Fitzgerald. Scott Fitzgerald, who wrote The Great Gatsby, said the rich are different. And Hemingway wrote back and saying, yes, they have more money. And we're allowing people, especially the professional class, and that's about 17 million Americans. We're talking about those who are hedge funds leaders, Wall Street financial leaders, lawyers, doctors, accountants, CPAs, professors, scientists, those who have more advanced degrees and have provided their family and themselves with the illusion that they should be selected for their advice on anything and everything. So no matter what the problem is, let's just say for an example on global warming or vaccines or genetically modified foods or the safety and greenness of nuclear, they'll come in and they'll support that. They'll support the corporate side of this. They'll support the establishment side. They'll support those who are making money from these. And then they'll attack those who have truth on their side. And then the media immediately casts one group, like a Chris Hedges or Nellie Bailey or the people doing Black Agenda Reports or myself or anyone else as, well, the other. So we're not getting honest information before the public so they can make intelligent, informed insights and therefore support organic or support only safe vaccines, which have not been coming forth yet, or supporting stopping these private-public giveaways of giving away all of our, you know, our highways to people who want to then charge us to drive on them and don't benefit us at all. So we are not dealing with these until we deal with all these issues, explaining to people what Citizens United is. Most people would not know what Citizens United is. They wouldn't know where do we put our spent nuclear fuel. They wouldn't know. There's no place to put it. They wouldn't know about Fukushima still devastating every 24 hours, spewing radiation, and we haven't done a damn thing to stop it. They wouldn't know that glyphosate can cause cancer. They wouldn't know that eating organic and a plant-based diet is something we could do. They wouldn't know that by planting a billion trees in the United States, we could make a substantial step forward in helping recapture that carbon dioxide and bring it back into the soil. They wouldn't know that, as you mentioned, that the permafrost is melting, and when that releases unknown toxicants, unknown molds and viruses, but also it's going to send methane up into the atmosphere in amounts we've never experienced before in our history. They're unaware of all this because the media won't tell the truth about anything. your final thoughts on this, please.
Yes, that's why I say, Gary, that this access to the internet and the free access to the internet is the key here. This is what provides the unique moment that we have, this opportunity that we have, that, you know, that one can go into the local cable television station in one's local community, you know, towns and cities the size of 30 to 50,000 people. You can go into the cable television station and broadcast to everybody in the local area, videotape those particular programs, and then put the videotapes up on the internet, on YouTube, for example, in other places. That what we need to do is there needs to be, as Greta Thunberg said, you know, in order to solve a crisis, you first have to come to acknowledge that it's a crisis, and you have to deal with it as it's a crisis, not just one other issue that needs to get addressed. That's why this issue of global climate change has come upon us now in such a clear and convincing manner, and that we need to address it through the context of the Green New Deal, and we need to get up onto the airwaves through the internet to educate our people. They say there are 30 separate sections of the Green New Deal that we're drafting for the state of California. Each and every one of those is subject to a seminar, a set of lessons about what the issue is, what the solutions are, what the problems are, et cetera. That's what I think we should do, that we have this open window right now because the technology of the internet has come upon us so rapidly that the major corporate-owned media has not, in fact, figured out yet how to get control of it, how to keep the average people. Sorry about that. Yeah, this availability of this access that we have to the internet, of so many people now having access through their cell phones or their laptops into the community. This information is something that the elite has not yet figured out how to stop. And so that what we need to have is like an Arab Spring. We need to have a North American Spring where the people rise up through the internet, use it to organize meetings, use it to hold seminars, use it to organize people and educate people and get people to go to the various websites that exist that contain deep information about these subjects. This is the opportunity we have. The critique of the corporate-owned media is absolutely correct that you undertake, and the availability of the internet still, before they get control of this, before they get control of it. There's a decision that just came out of the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the harbinger of what's to come. They have ruled that the Twitter account that Trump has, as much as we don't like him and we don't agree with necessarily what he's saying, they've ruled that that is a public forum, and therefore the government has the right to intervene and regulate what takes place in that realm. There, we know that the elite are desperate to figure out a legal theory pursuant to which they can gain control over the internet, but they haven't done it yet. We've got this window open of the next 18 to 24 months before they can figure out how to seize control of the internet. They're talking now about, you know, doing the same thing for our electoral process with the computers for the voting. We know that there is this short window of opportunity here for the next 18 to 24 months where we can push forward, use all of the resources of the internet, and put forth these concrete solutions to these fundamental and profound problems that we can educate the American people about. But we have to treat it as an emergency mobilization. Everybody has to get on board this. That has spent the last 50 years, you know, exploring these problems and analyzing.
We're running out of time.
Covering the evidence.
Let me just cut you a little short here. Sorry, but we're not all going to get behind anything. But we don't need everyone. If we had 3.5% of the American public in unity supporting something, it's enough to make it happen. That's over 12 million people. My concern is that the majority of the professional class that I alluded to earlier, they're in the status quo. Their whole life is their career, the benefits of their work. They're not spending time on any of the demonstration lines. They're not writing their legislators. And they somehow they feel that they're immune. Their money, their power, their social position gives them a get-out-of-jail-free. Somehow the environment's not going to adversely affect them. Food shortages won't affect them. People suffering in the United States and around the world from climate change catastrophes won't affect them. That is hubris, bounded by arrogance and narcissism. Danny, thank you for enlightening us and bringing us these insights. I very much appreciate it.
Thank you, Gary. I appreciate it.
Danny Sheehan, and we must work together. I'm Gary Knoll for the Progressive Commentary. Thank you all for listening.
Mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, there's far too many.